lifted his weight to one leg, bracing the other in front of himself, slightly bent so that his posture had a forward slant, a silent challenge to it. A familiar rush of queasiness swirled through me. Since I was little, I'd known the feeling of a conflict working toward a flashpoint. Apparently, Paul didn't have a clue about things like that. He smiled and jutted an open hand toward Ross. "Paul Chastain." The greeting was relaxed and casual. Ross gave him the eye, and Paul just stood there with his hand hanging, like he didn't even notice that he was failing to read the intentional man sign for "back off." Finally, Ross shook Paul's hand.
"Ross."
He followed with a head jerk in the direction of his truck.
"Come on, Tandy. Windswell's got the surf pump and waste plus off Pea Island. Gotta fix a faucet in one of the rentals, and then I'm headed that way to meet the crew."
His lips squeezed tight over the last word in a way that made it more than a casual invitation. This was a test. "Sure." I knew Paul was watching me. He rubbed his chin with the backs of his fingers, sliding the stampede string over his ear as his gaze fluttered past mine, a question in it. Ross was already striding across the parking lot to his truck. I could feel the distance growing, the pressure increasing like a rubber band tightening. If I didn't give, it would snap, and Ross would be off to the beach without me. There was a good chance he wouldn't be coming back again after that. "Well, enjoy your crab dinner," I said awkwardly, then turned and trotted after Ross. He was already settling into the driver's seat and starting the engine as I stepped onto the running board. For a minute, I thought he'd decided not to unlock my door, but then the button clicked and I slid in just before the truck lurched forward. All four wheels spun, spitting out a shower of gravel that pinged against the metal on Bink's door. I imagined Paul ducking out of the way, protecting the bucket of blue crab, but I didn't look back to check. "Jeez, Ross, Bink has probably taken down your license number so you can complain to the police the next time they come in for donuts." Ross rolled his eyes and snorted.
"I don't give a rip about Bink."
The edge in his voice pushed something heavy through my stomach again, and what was left of Geneva Bank's sausage created a hungry, sick feeling that took me back to Dallas. I hated it when Trammell talked to me that way, like he was disgusted by so many things about me and I'd just reminded him of every little flaw. Ross rolled down his window, and the breeze swirled my hair away from my face, cooling the burn in my cheeks. It wasn't right for me to hold things against Ross just because I'd been stupid enough to get myself involved with a man like Trammell Clark. Ross and Trammell weren't anything alike. Ross made an honest living, for one thing. He worked hard. He was entitled to be in a bad mood if he wanted to, and he had come by Fairhope to find me, which meant that I mattered. He could have just headed for the beach without me. Of course, then he and his friends wouldn't have anyone to run video cameras while they surfed, which was usually my job. Ross looked me up and down, taking in the holy knee jeans and the t-shirt that was dirty from working all morning at Iola's.
"Where have you been, anyway? I stopped by your place looking for you a minute ago."
"I went up to Bank's to get some trash bags. I'm doing some cleaning work for the church. That'll take care of my rent for a while, I hope." I left it at that. I had a feeling if Ross knew I had the key to Iola's big white house, he'd expect to take a look inside. He was curious, just like everyone else. We passed the driveway, and he pulled off into the ditch.
"You need anything from your place?"
A mixture of guilt and curiosity nibbled at me as I looked through the trees at Iola's house, and for a fraction of a second I wished that Ross hadn't come by. I needed to be working, but more than that, I wondered what other pieces of Iola's life I might find in there. After reading her letter on the desk yesterday, I'd started peeking in drawers and looking in cabinets when I didn't need to. I hadn't found anything else like the letter, or much of anything personal at all. It was almost as if Iola were only a visitor in the house, keeping her life in containers rather than moving in. What would cause her to do that? Was she afraid of something in there?
"Tandy, you need anything from your place?"
Ross repeated, wrapping his fingers over the gear shift impatiently. "Sorry, I zoned out for a sec. Actually, I was trying to remember whether I'd locked all the doors at Iola's before walking over to Bink's for trash bags. I couldn't go away and leave the place open, but I didn't want Ross to see me with the keys either. You know what?" I turned to him and smiled. "Why don't you just drop me here and come back after you fix the faucet?" As much as I liked wandering the decks and checking out the view at the rental places, I couldn't take the chance that Brother Gilbo might come by and find Iola's house hanging wide open. "That way I won't be holding you up. It's not too far for you to run back by for me, is it?" He shrugged.
"Yeah, I guess not. Whatever. I'll be back in 45.
He frowned and checked his watch, a fancy titanium lowdown with some feature he could use to check the tide on 200 beaches around the world.
Less, if I can patch this stupid thing back together, good enough to hold for a while. Be ready.
I will. I slid out the door and started toward the cottage, then turned in the direction of the main house when Ross was out of sight. The water was running upstairs when I stepped through Iola's front door. It sounded like a flash flood might cascade through the plaster any moment. Oh, no. Kicking the door shut behind me, I ran up the stairs two at a time. Luckily, when I reached the bathroom, the sink was keeping up well enough so that the basin was only half full. As soon as the faucet was off, the drain slurped away the remaining pool, then went silent. In the quiet, the sound of bells pressed through, the music high and soft, drawing me down the hall and into the turret room. This time, the cat was standing in the window with one paw braced on the glass and the other toying with the bells on the sun catcher. One, two, three, in succession, then two, then one, one, three, two, one, as if he were listening to the tone of each bell and putting together a melody. What are you doing up here again? My voice disturbed the dust in the air, and the cat paused to look at me, his topaz eyes blinking slowly beneath the bitten-off ear. The shepherd's hooked tail twitched slightly. You know, you're about the ugliest cat I've ever seen. His nose lifted a little, the gesture conveying that he really had no use for my opinions. Turning soundlessly, he crossed the walnut night table, then circled Iola's resting spot before rolling over in the center of the quilt and stretching his front paws into a patch of indigo fabric. What? You're not going to run and hide this time? A twitch of the broken ear and a yawn answered my question. Yeah, well, don't go turning on the water anymore either. Chewing my lip, I glanced at the tangle of rickrack and ribbon near the box on the writing desk. In fact, I think I'll take care of that issue right now. There's a bowl in the kitchen, you know. You can go down there for a drink if you're thirsty. Since I couldn't figure out how the cat was getting in and out, I'd set up food and water dishes yesterday before I left the house. I couldn't find any cat chow, but Iola's kitchen was loaded with Beanie Weenie cans with varying expiration dates. As long as the cat liked Beanie Weenies, he'd be in good shape. If he knew how to use a can opener, he could survive here forever. You have turned on your last faucet, buddy. I pointed a finger at him, a declaration of war, of sorts. I knew just how to make sure there was no more danger of unexpected flooding inside the house. 20 minutes, and some of Iola's ribbon and rickrack was all it took to tie every available faucet firmly into place, making them kitty-proof. I almost wished the cat would follow me so I could see the look on his face when he encountered my handiwork. The urge to find him and officially lay down the gauntlet before I left became overwhelming, so I trotted up the stairs with the last of the rickrack dangling between my fingers. He was still lounging in the blue room. Okay, if you can get those faucets to turn on now, you're more than just a normal cat, and I'm not coming back in this house, I joked. But since I'm the one with opposable thumbs and control of the can opener, you might want to think twice about running me off. I twizzled a piece of rickrack along the edge of the bed, and the cat looked at me like, Do you really think I'm going to fall for that old kitty-kitty-kitty trick? Go find some fluffy little thing named Fifi if you need a patsy to chase your ribbon around. His disinterested look made me laugh as I balled the rickrack into my palm. A slice of colored sunlight fell across it, giving the gold threads a glow, and I turned slowly toward the suncatcher in the window beside the bed. In the corner beyond, the closet door was open, a crack revealing the fathomless darkness of the space behind the library nook. That door wasn't open yesterday, I whispered to myself, or the cat, or the house, perhaps all three. I'd come to the point where it almost seemed natural to talk to the walls here. A strange warmth slid over me as I walked toward the closet. I thought of the dream that had haunted me after I found Iola's body, the blue room, the light, someone standing within it. The comfort I'd felt and the way it drew me in made me want to know more, to come closer. The reflection of hummingbird and passion vine caressed my skin, melted across it as I walked to the closet, slowly opened the door, let in a spill of light, caught a breath of dust and stillness and wonder. In the area near the door, clothes hung on wooden hangers, a fur coat, a man's suit, something that looked like a long black cape with a red satin lining, a pink dress and a matching pillbox hat, both encased in plastic. My gaze skimmed past, drawn instead to a patchwork of color and shape against the back wall. Cloaked in shadow, clothed in fabric and wood, adorned with ribbon, rick-rack buttons, multicolored bits of beach glass, and tiny shells with glitter sprinkled on like sand, they waited. A diorama of boxes upon boxes upon boxes, neatly stacked from floor to ceiling. Judging by the layer of dust, they'd been hidden there, keeping their secrets for a very long time. Chapter 7. I heard the car horn only dimly at first. I was crouched in Ayala's closet looking at the boxes. I'd slid another one off a shelf, a wooden box this time, the varnish old and yellowed, a faint image still visible on the lid. I touched the crackled paint, traced the sails of a galleon on a storm-filled sea. I'd figured out the organizational system of the boxes, peeked inside a few long enough to look at the dates, deduced that they ran left to right in rows, bottom to top, like the imitation hieroglyphs outside the Luxor Hotel in Las Vegas. Floor to ceiling, next to what must have once been a built-in ladder that provided access to an attic hatch high in the eaves, 14 feet at least. Far out of reach now, since the ladder steps had been pried off the wall at some point in the past. Every box seemed to be filled with Iola's letters to her father. Written on stationery and scrap paper of all types, the edges yellowed, the ink faded, the corners dissolved by time or eaten through by the tiny creatures that find their way into sealed boxes. Had her father stored them here, building a collection as the numbers grew? The shelving was as random as the boxes it held, created out of boards that ranged from oak table leaves to a bit of plywood to the flattened remnants of a LaMotte oyster crate. The oyster crate shelf was held together by more bent nails than straight ones. On the side walls, brackets had been made out of everything from metal cracker box lids to what looked like two broken bits of broom handle nailed on horizontally. My grandfather would have been appalled at the carpentry, and actually so would my father. Daddy had only taken on construction work when he couldn't make enough money buying and selling horses, but he was surprisingly good at building things. He kept me home from school and made me come along if he needed an extra pair of hands or a sober driver. I'd shuttled him to jobs since I was old enough to reach the pedals, so it never really occurred to me that it wasn't normal for a 10-year-old to drive across town. The upside was that I'd learned things that had come in handy later at some of the fixer-upper places I'd lived in before Trammell. I could have built better closet fixtures than these with a blindfold on and 6 fingers tied behind my back. It was a lucky thing Iola's shelves were holding no more than paper-filled boxes, some decorated with fabric and trams, some the salvaged packaging of days gone by. A wine carton, a bamboo tea container with Chinese characters printed in red, the shellac blackened and crazed. The wooden box in my hands looked ancient, like it might have traveled around the world in some sailor's chest before it came into Iola's collection. On the top shelf, the one far out of reach and supported precariously by broom handle brackets, a stained glass container sat last in line, looking far too heavy to be where it was. The car horn blared long and loud outside, and I fell off balance into the wall, realizing with a quick note of panic that I'd been so mesmerized by the boxes, I'd forgotten all about Ross. High on its shelf, the stained glass container trembled, then settled into place again as I returned the sailing ship box to its correct position and hurried from the closet. Downstairs, I rushed through checking locks, left via the back door by the kitchen, crossed behind an overgrown bayberry hedge, and came out from behind the cottage. Ross had exited the truck and was on the cottage porch, trying to find me. "Where have you been?" He looked me over, taking in the disheveled hair and the same clothes I'd had on when he left. Then he peered around the corner of the cottage like he expected to find someone there. "Finishing up some stuff for the church. I lost track of time, sorry. Let me grab a couple things, and I'm good to go." Ross licked his lips, holding the bottom one between his teeth, and looking from me to the backyard again before he turned and walked back to his truck. I let myself into the cottage, grabbed what I needed, locked the door, and was in the passenger seat in under 2 minutes, which wasn't fast enough. Ross gunned the engine on the way out, his chin stiff, his eyes focused straight ahead.
"So, who's the guy?"
he demanded as we pulled onto the narrow tree-lined street that led from Iola's house to Highway 12. "What guy?"
"The guy at the store."
A hard look came my way.
"The loser in the flamingo shirt."
I was afraid to ask why Ross was bringing Paul up again. "He mowed the lawn the other day. Well, Annie's JT's teacher. I just bumped into him at the store when I went for trash bags." Ross leaned back in his seat, one arm resting atop the steering wheel, his thumb sliding across the pads of his fingers.
You come back by just now, while you were at the house?
No. The word puffed out in a little cough. Nobody was over there but me, Ross. He's JT's teacher, and he introduced himself when he saw me at Banks. That's all.
Yeah, well, maybe you shouldn't hang around the store, letting your kid's teacher hit on you.
Considering that he was headed out to surf, Ross was in an intensely foul mood. I'd never seen him quite like this. No doubt he was irked that his daddy had him out fixing faucets while the waves were good. He hated working for his daddy. He wasn't hitting on me. He was showing me a crab trap. He'd been out crabbing. Suddenly wishing I'd stayed at Iola's, I pushed closer to the door as we swung onto the highway. I wanted to know more about the boxes, but after turning Ross down the night he got home, I was lucky he hadn't hooked up with that girl from Captain Jack's, taking her to the beach. She could probably run a video camera, too. It crossed my mind that I should have left a note for the kids to let them know where I was. When Ross hit the water, there was really no telling how long he'd be there. I would have thought of that if I hadn't been in such a hurry. Fortunately, Zoe would look after JT this afternoon, whether there was a note or not. She'd gotten in the habit of not assuming anything.
Yeah, right. He invite you over for a little crab dinner?
Ross was still sniffing down the same rabbit trail. The question had a sharp edge to it. Jeez, Ross, no, he didn't invite me over for dinner. I remembered my pap-pap having a crab trap like that, and I wanted to look at it, that's all. I'd been there like a minute before you came. Ross whipped past an SUV with kayaks racked on top, then ducked back in so late that an oncoming delivery truck had started moving over. A gasp sucked backward into my throat. I swallowed it soundlessly, my fingernails clutching the armrest. Ross wasn't usually wound quite this tight. So, tough time at work last week? I tried to change the subject.
What, now I'm the one who's got a problem? I come home from a trip, you make excuses not to come meet me. Then I drive up and find you flirting with some loser in a Holly shirt.
I tried to call you back. You wouldn't answer. I tried to find you yesterday, too. No matter what I said now, it wasn't going to make a difference. On the one hand, it felt good that Ross cared enough to be jealous. On the other hand, it was frustrating. Maybe we weren't as solid as I thought we were. The idea scared me. Without Ross, we had no security here, no one to help us if we needed it.
Yeah, whatever. That's why I've got all two of those missed calls from you on my phone. That's why I called your place like 6 times yesterday and you weren't there.
He grabbed his cell phone and held it up like it was proof of something. I told you I got a job finally. I was working yesterday, and I called you more than 2 times. You wouldn't answer.
Whatever,
he said again. I gave up talking and just looked out the window, letting Ross have some time to cool off. On a path toward Buxton Woods, a group of tourists on horseback plodded along. I'd seen riders go by in the trails along Mosey Creek a time or two. That looks like so much fun. I've never ridden on the beach. I didn't even realize I'd said it out loud at first. The most carefree moments of my life had been spent on the back of a horse. When I was young, there were usually horses at home that needed riding, although we were lucky if any of them were actually fit for kids to be around. Daddy liked to buy horses with bad habits, ride the hair off them for a few weeks, then take them to the auction barn when they were dead dog tired and put Gina or me in the saddle. We knew better than to act scared, even if we were. Buyers paid good money for something that seemed gentle enough for kids. We also knew that by making a horse look good, we were probably saving a life. If the saddle horse buyers didn't outbid the slaughter buyers, those horses were headed for a dog food can. Either way, Daddy got his money.
Yeah, well, maybe you can find some guy to take you out riding,
Ross snapped.
You want me to let you out?
I rubbed the little drum beat between my eyebrows and wished Ross hadn't found me today after all. At least not when he was in a mood like this. It was hard to believe that not long ago I was dropping the envelope into Jeremy's truck and feeling like the day had magic sprinkled over it. I tried to leave off analyzing things as we passed through Buxton and continued along the Cape Hatteras National Seashore, where the beach houses gave way to wild, unspoiled country, the land so narrow at times that the sound peeked through on one side, placid and glassy, while the blue-green waters of the Atlantic churned against the dunes on the other. Ross chilled a little and turned on the radio as we passed by Avon, then drove the narrow strip to Salvo, Waves, and Rodanthe. The farther north we went, the more intense the leftover hurricane damage grew. Neighborhoods that had been filled with mansions on stilts now sported empty spaces next to massive beach homes that teetered uneven, the pilings splayed out like the legs of a new colt, the property owners unable to come up with the money for repairs. Caution tape and condemned signs spoke the fates of homes now permanently off-kilter. Balconies dangled forlorn, and outside stairways had been removed, leaving the houses unreachable. In my mind, I heard my grandfather complaining about people building multi-story homes right on the beach. To him, the only things that belonged there were saltbox cottages like the ones in Old Nag's Head, nothing fancy kind that were fully expected to die a death at sea sooner or later.
What do they think? The storms will never come. You build a house on the sand shifts eventually, Tandy Joe. You remember that?
When we'd come here, after the storm all those years ago, I thought Pap-Pap could fix anything, including my parents. Now I knew that sometimes life is like those flooded houses. You can keep driving yourself crazy fighting the sea, or you can leave the past behind, find dry ground, and build somewhere new. Somehow or other, I'd find a way to do that. Ross's mood took a turn for the better when we pulled off the road in a spot already packed with boards and cars with wetsuits hanging on them. He was smiling from head to toe as he stepped out of the truck. "Hey, cowboy," some surfer chick called to him as we crossed over the dunes. The surf crew all called him cowboy, and you didn't have to hang around with Ross long to know that even if he didn't go for long hair and surfer duds, the other guys admired his skill with a board. He had soul, as they put it. Within a few minutes, he was out of his jeans and shirt and into a Hurley wetsuit over his swim trunks. He handed me the camera bag in a folding chair, knuckle-bumped with a couple of his bros on the beach, then stood with a group of them talking over the conditions, their hands moving in surfer sign language, mimicking the shapes of the waves and reenacting some epic wipeouts. I set up my beach chair, pressing the back of it into the sand until it was level, then settled in and took a big breath. The sun on my hair and the thrum of the tide made me feel good again. Compared to most of the guys who hung out on the water, Ross was more intense, less mellow than the surfer vibe called for, but even he couldn't help getting relaxed out here. The sand swirled around my toes, sun warmed on top and cold underneath as I rolled up my jeans. You couldn't have paid me to get in the water this time of year, but on the beach it was glorious today. A friend of Ross's, a skinny, loose-jointed kid the guys called Gumby because he wore a lime-green wetsuit, lifted a hand and waved at me. "Hey, cowboy girl, you gonna run video? You tape for me?" I nodded and shot him the high sign, and he trotted off to get his camera. Ross's friends had taken to call me Cowboy's Girl at first and then just shortened it to Cowboy Girl when they found out I used to show horses. They thought that was cool. And they liked having someone around who could run a camera, check weather reports on an iPhone, operate a stopwatch, and mentally calculate the average period between waves by timing the frequency as they struck a pier or buoy. The breeze combed my hair, and I closed my eyes, listening to the water. At the edge of the sea like this, it was hard to believe anything could be wrong. I loved being part of the surf crew, feeling like I had friends here after so many years of trying to fit in with Trammell's social circle and still being labeled a gold digger, someone who'd use her horrific accident to worm her way into his life and his finances. That couldn't have been further from the truth, but it didn't matter anymore. By now, Trammell's friends were probably hearing about him on the news. I'd made preparations before I left town, printed a stack of private emails between Trammell and his business partners, and sent them to an investigative reporter on Channel 8. With a little digging, the reporter would be able to uncover everything. No more of those young patients Trammell referred to as government charity cases would be subjected to unnecessary medical treatments, or strapped down in a dental chair while healthy baby teeth were filed off and a mouthful of silver crowns were crammed into place in rapid succession. Considering all the things Trammell criticized about me, all the things he held over my head, you'd think he would have remembered that I'd been one of those childhood charity cases. I remembered what it was like to have people you barely knew take you into a medical clinic, distort a few truths, and walk out with prescriptions for drugs to keep you placid and easy to manage. As if it's abnormal for a child to be emotional when home life is a roller coaster ride with occasional holes in the track. I knew what those kids in Trammell's medical and dental clinics were going through. They were more than numbers in a Medicaid file. But here, by the water, Trammell and all the rest of it seemed far away. There wasn't a thing to worry about. There couldn't be. The outside world didn't exist here. With any luck, the story had broken and Trammell was in jail, where he belonged. A tiny ghost crab scuttled a few feet from its hole and rushed back in, as I grabbed a pair of Ross's spare sunglasses and waited for Gumby to bring his camera. Once everything was said and done, I had 5 cameras and 5 guys to tape, plus 1 guy's surfer girlfriend. The afternoon went by in a rush. As the sun slid low over the water, the wind quieted and the breakers flattened out. Some of the guys built a fire and hung a kettle over it. I helped dump in corn, potatoes, and a couple pouches of Old Bay crab boil spices before grabbing the camera to catch Ross on his last trip of the day. The wave was small but clean, and he stroked it like an artist, cutting smooth curls, teasing the frothy tip. I zoomed in and watched his face, studied his intensity. Ross was never just having fun. He was always perfecting his art. The breaker collapsed, and he rode the momentum in, his body silhouetted against the blushing sky, a magazine cover image. For an instant, I wish Trammell could see me now, dating someone like Ross, surrounded by friends who actually liked me, just hanging out on the beach, enjoying everything this place had to offer. Trammell was wrong when he'd said that if I left him, I'd be sorry, that I was nothing without him and the pills. He'd used them to keep a thumb on me, told me I needed them to get past the leftover nerve damage from the accident and the emotional side effects of no longer being able to ride competitively. I'd trusted him in those confusing first months. He was a doctor. He should know. He had become the source of medications, money, security, everything I thought I needed to survive. But the truth was, I didn't need any of it. This place was healing me, giving me a new life, cleansing me body and soul. Ross paddled back out with a couple of buddies, and they sat on their boards a while, their hands once again speaking the silent language of breakers and tubes. Finally, they rowed in, and he jogged up the beach as a few of the guys pulled the boiling basket from the pot, dumped the vegetables on a pad of newspaper spread over a beach towel, then put shrimp, crab, and sausage in the basket before submerging it again. The water frothed over the edges of the pot, droplets hissing into the fire, gone in an instant. Ross slid a damp hand over my shirt, leaned close and kissed me, then shook out his short dark hair, the spray pelting both me and the fire. The flames complained, finding a voice again. "Ross," I squealed, shielding the video camera. He laughed and wicked water off his wetsuit, flicking it at me.
"You get good video?"
The wetsuit made rubber noises as he unzipped it. He looked good in it. He looked good without it. "I got good video," I said. Smiling, he reached for the camera, his dark eyes dancing in the light.
"I knew you were good for something."
He gave me a look that smoldered with hidden invitations. "Funny," I sneered playfully at him. The fight was over. Ross and I were good again. Gumby trotted up with a small blue cooler.
"Dude, you forgot these."
He opened the lid and dumped another pile of blue crab and sausage into the pot. Watching the crab tumble in, I thought of Paul Chastain and wondered if he was all by himself somewhere, having his fresh-caught dinner. I felt bad about the way we just left him standing there in the parking lot at Banks. Thinking of Banks reminded me of the kids and the fact that it was getting dark. At home, Zoe would have everything under control, of course. She'd be fixing dinner, making sure JT got his homework done, eventually hollering across the house that if he didn't get off Zago Wars and go to bed, she was going to come in there and rip the cord out of the stupid thing. They'd both be psyched about all the food I'd brought over from Iolis this morning, especially the microwave popcorn and the tin full of Belgian waffle cookies. They'd probably have a snack fest all evening. Still, I should borrow Ross's phone and call to be sure everything was okay. A good mother would have thought of that before night started to settle in. Chapter 8. I knew something was wrong the minute we turned into the driveway. The cottage was dark. No TVs on, no signs of activity. Iola's house loomed large and silent in the background, the only light a faint glow from a lamp downstairs. "They're not here. Where could they be?" The past rushed through me, wild and unbridled, and I saw my mother staggering out of some guy's truck, yelling down the road as a CPS caseworker drove away with us in the back seat of his car. The idea of that nightmare, repeating itself, crowded my mind now. Had Trammell found us? Maybe tipped off the police here? Or had he come here himself and taken my kids to prove that we would never be free of him?
"If you ever tried to leave, I'd find you, Dandy."
He'd always promised that. Nightmare scenarios spun in my mind, one right after another. What if something else had happened? What if JT had walked over to the marina and gotten in some kind of trouble? What if he'd fallen off the dock, hit his head, sunk beneath the water without a soul around to notice? What if he'd been lured into a car with a stranger? He was still so little. Could Zoe be out looking for him, trying to find him?
Chill out, Tandy.
Ross was somewhere between supportive and irritated that we'd had to leave the beach boil.
The kids are probably with that punk football player Zoe's so hot about.
For whatever reason, Ross didn't like Zoe's boyfriend. I could never quite tell whether he was looking out for her or just jealous because Zoe liked Rowdy a lot better than she liked Ross. They never turn the lights off when they leave. Unhooking my seatbelt, I reached for the door handle before we were completely stopped. They haven't been here since school got out, Ross. Something's wrong. Zoe wouldn't take off until almost 9 o'clock at night without letting me know. She has your cell number, and Rowdy has a phone. I've been trying to call Rowdy's phone for 30 minutes now. No answer.
Ross scoffed, a suggestive chuckle rolling under his breath.
You even watch her with that ratty kid ever? I can pretty much tell you where she's at. She probably dropped her little brother off at the arcade or someplace, and she and Romeo are out in the back seat of the Jeep, right?
Stop it. Halfway out the car door, I wheeled on him. Don't talk about her like that. Ross blinked slowly, his head cocking to one side.
Well, don't go all Jerry Springer on me. I told you that you ought to get her away from that kid, though, didn't I? You don't look out, Tandy. You're going to be a grandma. And I'm not interested in raising a baby.
I slid out of the truck and slammed the door hard behind me. The cottage was deathly quiet when we stepped inside. Calling the kids' names, I checked the rooms. No one there. No sign that anyone had been. No note. They were just gone.
Well, they've got to be someplace.
Ross was standing in the living room, and even he looked a little concerned.
When that girl gets home, you need to bust her chops, I'm telling you. You better get her under control before she ends up in real trouble. I've got a little sister, and she...
Ross, please! My hands were shaking, my entire body a rush of blood and fear. My voice echoed against the close-set walls of the cottage, high and shrill.
Jeez, calm down.
He reached for me, pulled me against his chest, and I pressed my hands over my face. His voice rumbled near my ear.
Here, I'll call a buddy of the sheriff's department, if that'll make you feel better.
Nodding, I took in his salty scent, the comfort of his arms, the muscles circling tight, encasing me in the assurance that I had someone to rely on, someone who cared. He reached into his jeans pocket, pulled out his cell.
You know, we need to get you a cell phone.
His fingers slid into my hair as he paged through his contacts, then talked to a friend at the sheriff's department, not surprisingly, a woman.
Well, nothing to report.
His motion was relaxed and casual as he tucked the phone back in his pocket.
See, I told you they're just out and doing whatever. They'll show up. Relax.
He stepped away from me, and my skin went cold where his warmth had been. In the tiny living room of the cottage, Ross seemed out of place, his bulky 6'4" frame dominating the space as he looked around, trying to decide what to do next.
You got anything to eat in this place?
Eat? Huh? Nothing had been reported to the sheriff, but still, my kids were missing. Zoe wouldn't do this, especially not when they had school the next day. I can't think about food. I have to know where my kids are. Ross's sigh communicated his frustration.
You're going to have to relax, Tandy. They'll show up when they're ready. And then you can whip some tail. Till then, there's no sense starving to death. Man, I could go for some of that beach boil right now.
He wandered off to the kitchen and started rummaging through the box of goods I'd brought home from Iola's house.
What's with all these cans of beanie weenies? Haven't you got any meat around here except hot dogs? No wonder that kid of yours looks like he's a baby anorexic. Man needs meat.
Ross's voice faded into the background as I wandered out the front door and stood gripping the porch railing. Tears pressed again. Please, please, I heard myself whisper. I wanted Rowdy's car to come rolling up the driveway. I have to be all right. Beyond the old stable yard, the church bells rang, then stopped.
Who are you talking to?
Ross passed by the door with a spoon in one hand and a can of Iola's Beanie Weenies in the other.
Standing out there won't make them show up any sooner.
He scooped a bite from the can, swilled it around his mouth, and swallowed.
These aren't half bad. It's not crab legs and corn, but it's food. You want me to fix you a plate?
I didn't answer, but walked to the steps, searched the yard, and listened to bullfrogs croaking in the sedges, the hush of wind across salt meadow hay, the seemingly endless trill of a nightjar calling. A fog rolled off the sound, creeping through the bayberry hedges, filling the low places first, stringing upward in ribbons that hung suspended, silver bright, in the moonlight. I wanted to take JT's hand in mine, steal through the fog, whisper shh, as we moved closer to the bird's call. I would translate its song for him the way my grandfather had for me. Chuck Will's widow, Chuck Will's widow, Chuck Will's widow. The cat mewed, the sound mingling with the bird's call, their voices coming in rapid succession, a song in two parts, performed in perfect time. Chuck Will's widow, meow. Chuck Will's widow, meow. Chuck Will's. Slipping around the corner, I found the one-eared cat sitting in a spill of moon glow, his fur blue-black in the light. His gaze focused through a thin streamer of fog into the live oaks overhead, as if he were conversing with the nightjar. The bird stilled, and the cat looked my way, meowed, then swiveled toward the old stable. There was something in the fog, a faint light. Squinting into the darkness, I focused on it, lost it in the mist, then found it again, nearer this time. The cat took a few silent steps, maintaining the distance between us as I moved closer. What was that? What was out there? I blinked, tried to see. Light reflected against the vapor, outlining an image that faded into a bank of condensation, then reappeared again, took on a human shape. Person, seeming to hover in the midst. Someone small. A woman with long hair, carrying a lantern. The image pinned me where I was, left me mesmerized and terrified at once, unable to find my voice. Ross, I croaked finally. Mama? The specter answered. JT? The lantern stopped, the shadow figure coming no closer. A whiff of breeze stirred, lifted the long, thick hair, rippling it, flag-like. I had the sense that this was all just another dream, none of it real. The cat yowled and darted away. I thought of JT's words after his nightmare a couple days ago. I heard the cat screaming in the yard. They do it when there's a ghost. JT? I called out again, louder this time. Is that you? If that's you, you come over here right now. You hear me? The kitchen window slid open in the cottage.
Tandy, what the?
I didn't hear the rest of whatever Ross had to say. Next door, a car circled the church parking lot, the headlights strafing the stable yard, pressing over the veils of fog just long enough that I could see JT's scrawny form, shorts, skinny legs, tennis shoes with reflector tape, a light of some kind in his hand. He had a cloth wrapped over his head. Before the car had pulled away, I was running through the yard. I caught him by the bayberry hedge, scooped him to me, sobbing and gasping. He was here. He was safe. Trammell didn't have him. No one had him. Where were you? The words tumbled out. Where's your sister? Vaguely, I was aware of Ross leaving the cottage, his boots echoing on the porch, his footsteps crunching against the oyster shell path.
You scared your mama half out of her mind. He complained as he approached. Where have you been?
JT stiffened in my arms, pulled away, and reached up and snatched the thing from his head, a windbreaker hanging on only by the hood. His backpack slid on his shoulder, and he hiked it into place again. Where's Zoe? I looked toward the stable, expecting her to materialize as well. What could JT possibly have been doing over there? That building was one step short of falling in. Why would they go there in the dark? Folding the jacket against his body, he hugged it close. I don't know. His voice went high, then cracked. Her and Rowdy went someplace after school got out. I saw her at Binks when I got off the bus. She told me to just go on home, so I did. And she left with Rowdy.
Yeah, who guessed that one right?
Ross pointed out. I turned back to JT, grabbed his shoulders. Why weren't you at the cottage? Why didn't you let yourself in and wait like you're supposed to? I've been going crazy. The key was gone. JT's voice was barely audible. His shoulders crumpled beneath my fingers, shrinking inward. When I got home, the key wasn't under the mat, and Zoe didn't come. And you didn't come, so I went back down to Binks and helped the guys for a while. And then, so it was getting dark, and Brother Gilbo came to the store and said they were having a spaghetti dinner and a family movie night at the church, and
did I like spaghetti? And I said I did, so I had spaghetti. But it tasted so good, I ate too much spaghetti and popcorn. My stomach hurt. So then I went to the bathroom for a while after the movie was going. By the time I came out, the hallway was dark, and everybody was heading home. I saw the windows were lit up in our house, so I got my keychain light out, and...
Yeah, well, I'm glad somebody got to eat.
Ross braced his hands on his belt, towering over JT.
We missed out on a good beach boy because we had to come look for your little butt. If I ever did that to my daddy, he would have whipped me till I couldn't stand up straight, and then I would have known not to do it again.
JT backed against me, and I slid an arm around him. It's my fault for not putting the key back. While I was rushing off with Ross earlier, I'd forgotten to make sure the extra key was under the mat. For the past 2 days, I'd been using the one on the ring Brother Gilbo had given me. It's okay now. I turned to guide JT toward the cottage, holding tight to his shoulders, feeling the little points of bone beneath my fingers. There's no real harm done.
Yeah, except it screwed up our whole night.
We passed through the light from the kitchen window, and I could see Ross glaring at me, expecting me to take his side. Let's just go in the house. My body was quickly turning to mush, awash with relief as we made our way back to the cottage and closed the door behind us. I was ready to let the tension wane, not keep the fight going.
It's no wonder they don't listen worth a flip,
Ross complained. The can of Beanie Weenies hit the trash half full, and the spoon sailed across the kitchen and clattered into the sink. JT stopped, froze. He looked up at me, his eyes two brimming pools of ocean blue, the freckles over his nose trembling.
I would have come home before, but it was dark in here, and I was afraid of the ghost,
he whispered, ducking his chin. A nervous glance flicked toward Ross, then back to me. I shooed JT toward his room, then leaned against the corner of the hallway wall, my body still shaking, the nerves vibrating leaf-like and fragile under my skin.
I just need to catch my breath a little, okay? I'm sure Zoe will show up soon.
Yeah, we'll see,
Ross grumbled.
Guess I should go get the cooler out of the truck.
He walked out the door, and I sank down on the edge of the sofa, vacillating between being angry, being worried, and being confused. This just wasn't like Zoe. Where was she? She'd come in soon, of course she would, and she'd have a good reason for going AWOL tonight. She would be here any minute. Home. Safe. But hours ticked away as I waited on the sofa, alternately calling Rowdy's cell number and checking the driveway. By midnight, Ross was like a fighting rooster chained to a peg, and I couldn't take it anymore. Whenever Zoe did finally show up, things were going to be a mess, I could tell. One of Ross's friends called, and I was glad for the diversion. They'd moved the party from the beach to a house. They were jamming on guitars and hanging out, planning to crash for a few hours before hitting the water again in the morning. Tomorrow's forecast called for waves hip to waist. I urged Ross to go join the party, and then was strangely disappointed when he took me up on it. After he left, all I could do was let my head sag against the sofa and try to focus on the TV rather than the disaster scenarios in my mind. JT staggered up the hall, drowsy and clumsy, dragging the sleeping bag from his room. He curled up next to me, and I sat finger-combing the silken strands of his hair, trying not to think all the worst things. Sleep slipped over me sometime after midnight. When I woke, Zoe was sneaking past, trying to keep the worn plank floorboards from making noise as she crossed to the sand-crusted carpet runner that ran down the hallway. Zoe? I whispered.
Shh.
She pointed at JT. The two of us had collapsed into a heap, and I couldn't move without disturbing him. After the long day, my mind was slow and sluggish.
What time is it? Where were you?
I blinked hard, trying to sort out the muddle in my head. JT stirred in my lap.
Go back to sleep.
Zoe shifted from one foot to the other, rubbing her hands up and down her arms like she was half frozen.
We got Rowdy's truck stuck at the beach. I need to get some sleep. There's a stupid science test tomorrow.
She didn't wait for an answer, but disappeared into the bathroom, closing and locking the door behind herself. I slipped out from under JT, started toward the bathroom door, but decided to leave it be for tonight. Instead, I tucked JT in tight on the sofa, then stumbled off to my room. A heavy moon hung outside the window, its soft glow soothing me into sleep almost before my head hit the pillow. In the morning, Zoe was trying to get quietly out the door when I woke up. She had JT in tow and her backpack slung over her shoulder.
Where's the key? She demanded when she saw me in the bedroom doorway. She looked tired and red-eyed, her long brown hair hanging in tangled wet strings around her face. The dork said he got locked out yesterday because the key wasn't there.
Yes,
and he was wandering around after dark by himself because you weren't here, I snapped, my anger fresh and potent this morning. Zoe's jaw squared, her eyes flaring, revealing an odd mix of bloodshot red, dry pink, and sky blue. A miniature sunset in reverse.
You know what? You weren't here either. You're his mother, remember? You do whatever you want. Why can't I? Rowdy and me went to the beach. We got the truck stuck when we started to head home. His phone was dead, so we had to walk.
She spotted the key on the windowsill and snatched it up, then pushed JT out the door. He stumbled on the stoop and took a couple of running steps across the porch before catching his balance. Zoe slanted a narrow glare at me, her fingers closing over the knob.
We gotta go. We'll miss the bus.
The panes of glass rattled as the door slammed behind her. Fury flared in me, and I yanked it open, yelled into the yard.
You come home after school today, you hear me?
She didn't answer, just kept walking toward the marina with JT trotting along after her, shooting concerned looks back and forth. I stood watching, tears of frustration blurring the outlines of the kids as they reached the trail through the salt meadow and slowly vanished into the morning fog. The silence closed in hard and fast as soon as they were gone. It crossed my mind that Ross hadn't checked on us since he left last night. For all he knew, Zoe could still be missing, or worse. We weren't even on his mind. I wanted something medicinal to take the edge off that realization. But there were no crutches around, and that was for the best. It was easier to leave the pills behind when no one was handing them to me and watching to make sure I took them day after day. I showered, dressed, and went to Isla's house, leaving the cottage unlocked just in case Zoe lost track of the key. Not that I planned to go anywhere today. When Zoe showed up after school, and she'd better, she would listen to what I had to say. I refused to let my baby girl repeat my history. She was better than that. She deserved better. My parents might not have found much to like about me, but I loved my daughter, even if I wasn't good at showing it. I had hopes and dreams for her. Somehow, I had to make her see that. Isla's house was quiet and cool inside, the damp, foggy night still clinging in the corners. Good morning, Isla, I said, my voice echoing through the house. Today, I liked the feeling that I was not alone here, the sense that I was coming to spend the day with a friend who'd awaited my arrival. Setting my things on a little table in the vestibule, I looked toward the stairs. In the excitement last night, I'd forgotten all about Iola's boxes. Chapter 9
January 1st, 1933 Dear Father, Sister give this box to me. She say, I'll let you write to Father when you got the sadness in this place, and Father he gonna listen. Sister tell me put my letters in this box and hide it in my clothing chest where no one else gonna know of it. This box is secret between Sister and me. Not all secrets are sin, says Sister. She makes the box beautiful. Not all beautiful things are sin, she say. Were not the gifts of the Magi beautiful? I like the way Sister talk, all proper like Isabel. Beauty is created with purpose, say Sister. She hold my chin in her hand and lower her face close to mine, her eyes round and green like a fresh growth of daffodils. Beauty is created. It's intentional. She give extra voice to them big words, created and intentional, to be sure that I know they matter. I ask her just how the ABC's supposed to go in them words so I can write them good in my letter to you, the important words. We do not choose the vessel we're given, Iola Ann, but we choose what we pour out and what we keep inside, she say. This box, a vessel for my letters to you, Sister tell me. I gotta put in all the things I keep inside me, get them out in my words. This is good for the soul, Sister say. Tell Father your worries. He will understand. He knows you so well. I don't like the way I look. I don't tell this, even to Sister. They make me come here 'cause of my look. I ain't stupid, I know it. I wish I looked like Aurelia. She got long hair and braids, black as a dead coal. I pray this prayer every night. But in the morning, I wake up and run myself to the mirror in the water closet down that long hall, and still, they're the same girl looking back at me. She got a bad look. My heart's so empty for Mama T and Mama and Isabel. If I look a different way, I can go home again. I gotta believe even harder. I gotta believe you're gonna hear me, Father. I wanna go home. Your loving daughter, Viola Ann.
Letting the letter rest, I ran a finger over the words, carefully written in a child's slow, uneven print. My fingernail grazed the edge of the paper, slipped off onto the quilt, and snagged a stitch of white thread along an astor blue square. I hadn't even realized I was sitting on the bed, rumpling Iola's resting place. The oldest of the boxes, one that had been almost hidden among dust bunnies, stray fur, and cast-off ribbon scraps in the bottom left corner of the closet, lay upside down on the bed beside me, the contents in a neat pile, still shaped like the interior of the box. The uppermost shelf had me worried today. High out of reach, near the attic hatch, it had slipped off its rickety broom-handle bracket overnight, as if I'd disturbed the balance of things when I'd come into the closet yesterday. One side now rested on the shelf beneath it, the boxes compacted like train cars in a pile-up. The heavy stained-glass container was teetering with the others, one corner hanging in air. I'd looked for a stepladder, but so far I hadn't found anything taller than a kitchen stool. No way to reach the glass box. Finally, I'd tiptoed into the closet and started at the bottom instead, with a shoebox-sized container covered in a faded brocade fabric and decorated with bits of colored lace that had faded to pale shades of lilac and peach. The corners were smudged and worn. Now, with the first letter resting on the wedding ring quilt, I touched the box, thought of Iola's small hands holding it close to her body, opening and closing the lid, hiding her letters to her father inside. Had she ever sent them to him? If so, how had they ended up back in her box, neatly stacked?
They make me come here 'cause of my look. I ain't stupid, I know it.
Could her father have been dead already when she wrote the letters? Maybe that was why she was sent away from her family, because she was a reminder of him, because she looked like him? Maybe her mother had remarried and her stepfather didn't want her around. I knew how that would feel. All my life it had seemed like Mama and Daddy didn't really want Gina and me cluttering up their lives. They didn't want us, but they didn't want to give us to Pap-Pap and Meemaw for good either. We'd run from CPS more times than I could count, too. As a child, I mistook those wild flights for evidence of love, but as I got older, I didn't know what to call it. Possession isn't the same as love. Maybe Iola's family simply couldn't afford to feed and take care of her. 1933 was a depression. People were starving, standing in bread lines. Kids were sent away. During my ill-fated freshman year of college, a history teacher had shown us photos of destitute families fleeing the Dust Bowl. The vacant, weary expressions on the women's faces brought back memories of my mama when she woke up hungover and worn out. Could Iola and her sister have been in an orphanage when Iola wrote the letter? Maybe it was the only choice her family had. Who was Aurelia, and why did Iola want to look like her? Why did she believe that would make things better? Was it a child's unrealistic fantasy, like all the times I'd convinced myself that if I could just be a better girl, smarter, prettier, quieter, more helpful with the house, less trouble to have around, my parents would stop fighting, my daddy would come home every night, and my mama would be like the other moms at school, up and dressed each morning, waving goodbye to the school bus. My heart ached for Iola, alone in a strange place in 1933. She must have been only about 10. In a few years, she would realize that there was nothing she could do to change the world around her, to repair the people she needed most. The missing pieces were out of reach of her tiny hands, the broken places not hers to mend. In my adult mind, I understood that, but deep inside me, there would always be the girl who wondered if she could have fixed things. Iola's letter reached into that little girl in a way nothing else ever had. I found myself spinning a web that intertwined Iola's story and mine, my thoughts running over the silky threads on nimble spider legs, creating intricate patterns. A little girl, trapped and helpless, afraid, waking each day to find her prayers unanswered. I'd prayed the most desperate prayers of my life here on Hatteras. For a while, they'd seemed to be working.
Finally, after so many chaotic, uncertain years, God had heard me and repaired my family, patching up all the broken places with sun and sand, ready construction jobs, easy money. The magic of this place, and Pap-Pap and Meemaw nearby. They'd promised to help my parents out, give them part of the farm to build a house on if Daddy would keep himself sober and take on construction work, and Mama would stay home to take proper care of Gina and me. Pap-Pap's job as an insurance adjuster gave him an in for lining up all the work my Daddy could handle. It could be a new start for all of us. Life would finally be good. Stable day after day. And then the post-storm construction boom was over, the repair work done, the tourists returning to grab up the available spaces, the rental prices rising. It was time to move to the farm across the sound on the mainland and start building our house. But Daddy missed Texas. He was tired of having to live by someone else's rules. He missed rodeos and horse auctions and trying to turn a quick buck so he wouldn't have to take as many construction jobs. The night he came home with a bottle and a paper bag, I knew my prayers hadn't been answered after all. The lopsided carousel of our lives had only been stopped for a while, and now it would resume its cockeyed motion, up, down, around, high and low, on and off. Iola's prayers wouldn't be answered either. At 10, she probably had no way of realizing that. Sooner or later, she would figure out that she was never going to wake up looking like Aurelia. I reached for the pile, slid my fingers over the next letter, lifted it free without disturbing the rest. The cat, sitting on the far corner of the bed, twitched an ear, then stretched lazily against a pillow sham latticed with blue granny circles and tatted lace. His raspy pink tongue curled as he yawned and blinked, seeming to already know the stories in these boxes. The half ear twitched again, reacting to the sound of old paper, as I unfolded another letter.
January 20th, 1933. Dear Father, Mama T say prayers only, just the words that blow away. Her mama had the voodoo. She come from a Haiti Isle on a tobacco ship, Mama T say. A slave woman to the tobacco man up in Caroline. He tell her not to do voodoo. He tell her she gotta be a Christian now. Mama T, she born a farm slave, but she don't remember that. She lived her life mostly in the quarter here in New Orleans, not in no tobacco field. But she still believe in the voodoo. Mama T said don't speak about none of that. Monsieur, he don't like that kind of talk, Mama T say to me. His family got a bad history with the voodoo from a long time ago, before Mama T come to work for Monsieur's folk and live in the big house by the quarter. My own mama just a little girl then, and I ain't even a dust speck yet. Benoit family give us everything. Always have. House to live, food to eat. They pay Mama T good. And then they pay my mom when she old enough. Treat us good. They love us like family. They let me learn my numbers and letters with Isabel. Let me learn that big piano just like Isabel. I wonder, did Isabel miss me now? Did she ask Monsieur Papa why you sent that old aunt away? Did Isabel hear Madame say, just look at her. I won't have it. I won't have her here. You understand me? There are places a child like her can be sent. Places where she'd be educated, taken care of, given her catechism properly. It isn't cruel. She'll be better off, and so will Isabel. Everything different since Monsieur marry again and bring Madame to the big house. Everything shiny and proper and careful. Isabel don't like it neither. Does she pray that I gonna come home? Do we say the same prayer when we open our beds at night? Hers so far apart from mine now. Maybe her prayer is better than mine. Maybe she'd do it right. Maybe you mad about the voodoo, Father. But I don't never do it. I don't believe it none neither. Sister Marguerite say you gonna answer her prayers in their own time. I keep praying my same prayer. Gonna keep writing it too. Keep putting it in my prayer box, Sister Marguerite give me. Keep waiting on you to answer. Keep wondering if you've been hearing these prayers. You gonna bring me home soon? Can you find me in this place where they got so many? Your loving daughter, Iola Ann. A mist of tears crowded my eyes. I knew how Iola felt, what she was thinking, what she was feeling. She was trapped in an orphanage or a school, some sort of warehouse for children whose families didn't want them around. Sister Marguerite wasn't her sister, but a nun, a teacher, or a caretaker.
The letters were Iola's prayers, her private thoughts. That's why they'd never been mailed. His letters weren't meant for Earth, but for Heaven. Not for her biological father, but for God. Iola's mother had sent her away. To please an employer? What kind of mother would do that?